saying, have a lovely day.
Today is Wednesday, October the 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. The U.S. Congress will vote to extend the federal debt limit. And Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta is calling for dialogue between the government of Ethiopia and the Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, to end the conflict in the country.
We do not believe that there is any military solution, and we need to urgently have all parties coming across a table in order for us to be able to ensure that all humanitarian corridors are actually opened.
Russia's foreign ministry says that Moscow has offered the U.S. to roll back mutual restrictions on diplomatic missions. And UN agencies warn that the window for providing humanitarian assistance for millions of Afghans in dire need is rapidly closing.
Let's not forget, winter in Afghanistan is harsh. Winter in Afghanistan can kill if people don't have the resources.
And European Union officials have warned that the bloc is at risk of collapse unless it challenges a ruling by Poland's top court over the supremacy of the EU law. We'll have these stories and more coming up right here on International Edition. Stay tuned. And for our top story, Congress will vote to extend the nation's debt limit through early December after the Senate approved a stopgap measure last week in a bid to avert a default. AP correspondent Mike Garcia reports.
Members of the U.S. House of Representatives returned to the nation's capital today to vote on temporarily extending the federal government's borrowing power to December. The Senate passed the debt limit extension Thursday night, approving $480 billion in new borrowing. The extension will avoid a first-ever federal default. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell allowed the two-month reprieve, but has said he won't do it again. 8 of the 11 Republican senators who helped Democrats approve the debt limit increase are either retiring or not up for re-election until 2024 or later. Mike Gracia, Washington.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott issued an executive order to prohibit any entity, including private businesses, from enforcing a COVID-19 vaccine mandate on workers. AP correspondent Julie Walker reports.
Abbott previously barred vaccine mandates by state and local government agencies, but until now had let private companies make their own rules for their workers. It was not immediately clear if his latest executive order would face a quick court challenge.
And American Airlines and Southwest Airlines said on Tuesday that they would comply with President Joe Biden's executive order to require their employees to be vaccinated for COVID-19 by a December 8 deadline. The two Texas-based carriers said the federal mandate superseded an order by Republican Governor Greg Abbott barring vaccine mandates.
Voice of America.
Many Americans are getting Pfizer booster shots, and federal regulators will soon take up if and when those who get their other COVID-19 vaccines will receive their booster. AP Sagamegani reports.
The FDA's independent advisors will meet Thursday and Friday to discuss extra doses of the Moderna and Johnson & Johnson vaccines. It's the start of a multi-stage process that's meant to boost public confidence in the vaccines, but has instead led to disagreements among agencies. This time, the advisors are likely to face more complicated decisions, like whether a third Moderna shot should be just half the original dose and when to dispense the J&J booster. No final recommendation on either shots expected for at least another week, since the CDC gets the final sign-off. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
Russia's foreign ministry says that Moscow has offered the U.S. to roll back mutual restrictions on diplomatic missions. AP's Charles de la Desma reports.
Russia has offered the U.S. to roll back several rounds of sanctions that have hampered diplomatic activity, but it's reaffirmed strong opposition to any U.S. military presence in the former Soviet Central Asian nations following the American exit from Afghanistan. The Russian proposal was made during the talks between Undersecretary of State Victoria Nuland and Russia's Sergei Ryabkov. However little progress appears to have been made on normalising the work of the diplomatic missions, which has been hampered by the successive sanctions. I'm Charles de la Desma.
You're listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. Leaders of the grouping of the world's 20 largest economies are holding a virtual extraordinary meeting Tuesday on Afghanistan, less than 2 months after the Taliban took over the country. Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi, who holds the rotating presidency of the G20, had pressed for the meeting, saying Afghanistan is headed for a humanitarian catastrophe. Sabina Casafranco reports from Rome.
Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi said Tuesday's closed-door virtual summit on Afghanistan would focus on security, humanitarian aid, and human rights in the country. It is being held less than 3 weeks before the G20 summit of world leaders to be held in Rome on October 30th and 31st. Since the Taliban returned to power on August 15th, following the U.S. troop withdrawal after 2 decades of war, there have been growing concerns about the humanitarian situation in the country. Leaders will hold discussions on how to combat terrorism, how to guarantee freedom of movement, both inside and outside Afghanistan's borders, for Afghans as well as members of non-governmental organizations, and the condition of women in the country, which Draghi has defined a priority. The Prime Minister spoke about Afghanistan in a recent interview on Italian state television. Draghi said that for Italy, the future is about defending fundamental rights, defending the rights of women, and protecting all those who have, over the years, exposed themselves to dangerous situations in order to defend these rights in Afghanistan. A major challenge will be pressing the Taliban on guaranteeing the rights of women who face discrimination and violence, including their full return to schools and to workplaces and their recognition in political life. Only boys are allowed to attend high school, and at present, more than 2 million girls are denied access to education, and Afghanistan has one of the lowest female literacy rates in the world, according to the World Bank. The summit has been extended to the Netherlands, Spain, Singapore, and Qatar, which has played an important role in the Taliban's dialogue with the West. Afghanistan's neighbors, Pakistan and Iran, were not invited to attend the summit, and Chinese media reported President Xi Jinping would not take part. But to maximize involvement, various organizations are also joining, including the United Nations, the European Union, the World Bank, and the International Monetary Fund. Afghanistan's spiraling economy and the need to provide humanitarian support also to nearby nations taking in refugees are central to the meeting. Italy's Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio has said he has asked for an increase in funds for cooperation in Afghanistan to help civilians. He added that everything must be done to avoid the state from collapsing, because he said if Afghanistan collapses, we will face uncontrolled migration to nearby nations with subsequent destabilization in the area. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
And meanwhile, UN agencies warn that the window for providing humanitarian assistance for millions of Afghans in dire need is rapidly closing. They note that winter is approaching and that access to remote, snowed-in areas will be cut off. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Relief officials say they fear the race to deliver and pre-position life-saving supplies ahead of winter may already be lost. They know temperatures have dipped below 0 Celsius at night, and snow has been known to fall in October in Afghanistan. Speaking on Zoom from the capital, Kabul, UN Refugee Agency spokesman Baba Baluch says the window is closing at a time when far too many people have yet to be reached.
Let's not forget, winter in Afghanistan is harsh. Winter in Afghanistan can kill if people don't have the resources, and if you end up being under the open skies. So it's really merciless, and it is very important to get that support to reach more and more Afghans as soon as possible.
Afghanistan is one of the world's worst emergencies. Nearly half of Afghanistan's population of 40 million required international aid before the Taliban took control of the country in mid-August. Baluch says those numbers are growing and include some 3.5 million people displaced by conflict. As needs also are growing, he says humanitarian operations must be scaled up quickly to win this race against time. He says the UNHCR is in regular contact with the ruling Taliban to help this effort go forward.
We rely on them in terms of access to areas. We rely on them for our securities. There are encouraging signs in that sense. And they have been kind of highlighting to us the needs of the people on the ground as we go and do more assessments and bring in more supplies.
Baluch says it is difficult for people not on the ground to know how dire and desperate conditions are for the Afghan people. He warns winter will just add to their prevailing miseries. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
European Union officials have warned that the bloc is at risk of collapse unless it challenges a ruling by Poland's top court over the supremacy of EU law. Large rallies were held across Poland over the weekend in support of EU membership, as Henry Ridgewell reports.
An estimated 100,000 people gathered in Warsaw Sunday to show support for Poland's EU membership. Among them was Donald Tusk, the former president of the European Council and now leader of the opposition party Civic Platform. Tusk told the crowd, "What is it that brought us all here today? A pseudo court of justice, a group of masqueraders in judicial robes by order of the party's leader in violation of the constitution, decided to take Poland out of the EU." The protests were triggered after judges in Poland's highest court last week ruled that the national constitution had primacy over European Union law. The supremacy of EU law is the legal bedrock of the bloc. Brussels officials Monday threatened sanctions against Poland. Didier Reynders is the EU Justice Commissioner.
We are waiting now for new decisions of the Court of Justice about the situation in Poland, also possible daily financial sanctions.
Those fines could amount to over $1 million a day. The legal case was originally brought by the Polish Prime Minister, Mateusz Morawiecki. He has refused to implement two rulings made by the European Union's Court of Justice in July, which accused the Polish government of political interference in the judiciary. The Prime Minister has denied such interference and said Poland is not seeking an exit from the European Union. Writing on Facebook, he described that idea as a harmful myth. Government supporters have staged counter-protests and say the government was right to challenge the EU. Among them was Zygmunt Miernik. He said they appropriate rights that they do not have the right to appropriate, and they want to interfere more and more. So how close is Poland to leaving the European Union? Piotr Buras is from the European Council on Foreign Relations.
This threat of Poland exit, of Poland leaving the European Union, is overblown. Poland is a country where more than 80% of the population is in favor of the EU membership. Poland is very much dependent on the internal market and also on the EU funds, including the recovery fund agreed upon last year.
That COVID recovery fund is worth $66 billion. The EU has threatened to withhold the money unless Poland implements the changes to its judicial system. Poland and some other member states, including Hungary, have repeatedly clashed with the EU over the rule of law, media freedom and minority rights. Again, Piotr Buras.
The battle we have now is basically about, will the European Union allow this to happen, that populist autocratic governments disregarding European standards and European laws lead to an erosion of the EU foundations.
those foundations have been shaken by the Polish ruling. European officials say the bloc must stand by its core principles or risk collapse. But so far, the Polish government shows little sign of changing course. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Amid a tumbling Lebanese pound and increasing inflation, major outlets and shops in Lebanon have started to close down. More than 400 shops have closed due to the economic crisis that has been ongoing in Lebanon since 2019. George Eade reports for VOA from Beirut.
Shops are closing down by the day and international brands are leaving the country in droves. Pavements that were once crowded with shoppers are now empty as some of the once vibrant marketplaces in Beirut and its suburbs have turned into ghost towns. Sami Risha, who lives in the suburbs of Beirut, says he is unable to find the products he used to buy because many shops have closed down.
The quality of the merchandise has generally downgraded, such as clothes brands. It became difficult for me to find some brands that I used to buy in the past before the economic crisis. Nowadays, companies can no longer survive in a country that incurs more losses.
For Reem, who lives with her family and two kids in central Lebanon, the shopping scene in Lebanon has changed entirely since the start of the economic crisis in 2019. New brands of lesser quality have replaced the international brands she used to buy, as she says.
I can't find the brands I used to buy, and many clothing brands have now closed down. And those who didn't close down eventually have now a limited selection with high prices, which makes it that a T-shirt that used to cost 16 Lebanese pounds now costs 200 Lebanese pounds. Things are becoming extremely hard even for basic products to find, which is making the Lebanese citizens' life harder and harder every day. At some point, a Lebanese citizen couldn't find bread in the supermarkets, nor in the bakeries, not even children's milk.
The triple economic shock that has hit Lebanon is a combination of a worldwide pandemic, an economic crash, and the Lebanese capital devastated after the explosion. This has brought the business owners to their knees after years of resilience. More than 400 storefronts in Lebanon have closed down for good in 2020, says Nicolas Chamas, president of the Beirut Traders Association.
We have been exposed to a supply problem whereby importers were not able to transfer money to their suppliers abroad. And as a result, the imports have fallen by almost 80% in some sectors. The other problem, and more important one, is the demand problem, because the purchasing power of the Lebanese population has collapsed.
With the ongoing hyperinflation and the Lebanese pounds losing more of its value every day, analysts expect that more and more shops will be closing down. This is George Aid reporting for VOA from Beirut.
Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta is calling for dialogue between the government of Ethiopia and the Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF. Speaking in New York after chairing a United Nations Security Council high-level open debate on diversity, state building and peace, Mr. Kenyatta says that there is no military solution to the conflict.
I think our position, which is the position of the African Union, is that we will continue to seek dialogue on all sides. We will continue calling for an immediate cessation of hostilities by both sides. We will continue to urge for the need to have a political resolution, because we do not believe that there is any military solution, and we need to urgently have all parties coming across a table in order for us to be able to ensure that all humanitarian corridors are actually opened and the people who are the greatest sufferers of this conflict do receive the much-needed aid.
Kenya shares a border with Ethiopia, and President Kenyatta says that both sides need to cease hostilities so humanitarian aid can reach all the people affected by the conflict.
So ours is to continue, first and foremost, to call for that ceasefire, to call for national dialogue, and for all parties to cease hostilities and be able to engage and find a political solution that will result in the people of Ethiopia to end their suffering, but also, most importantly, at this particular moment in time, to ensure humanitarian access to all the people.
Kenya won a seat as a non-permanent member at the UN Security Council earlier last year and currently holds the monthly rotational presidency of the council for October 2021. President Kenyatta was recently identified as a beneficiary of secret accounts revealed in recent reporting by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, known as the Pandora Papers. Kenyatta, who publicly campaigned against corruption, was asked about that report.
Well, as I said before, my name, first and foremost, is not there. And secondly, there has been no mention of any illegality or wrongdoing on my part. And as I said before, I left Kenya to come and attend this meeting. I will be addressing that issue comprehensively once I arrive back home.
U.S. President Joe Biden will hold talks with President Uhuru Kenyatta this Thursday at the White House. And in other news, Mexican President Andre Manuel Lopez Obrador said on Monday that well-known smuggling companies had engaged in what he described as fuel smuggling, and he named global energy trader Trafigura as an example of the practice. The comments marked a new development in a web of corruption probes of some of the world's biggest energy traders across several countries in Latin America. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. And while there, check out our other programs, including Upfront Show, television program Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and many others. And remember to connect with us on our YouTube channel. Search for VOA Africa. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. Researchers at Canada's McMaster University, writing in the Canadian Medical Association Journal, found that non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs such as ibuprofen are actually better at controlling pain than opioid-based codeine painkillers. They also provide fewer adverse reactions than codeine. Rick Pantaleo tells us more in this edition of Science in a Minute.
This is Science in a Minute.
Medications that include opioids have long been used as effective painkillers. But according to the Mayo Clinic's website, even brief use of opioids can lead to addiction and overdose. Opioid misuse and overuse have become a serious public health crisis in countries the world over, including the United States. Findings in a recent study by researchers at Canada's McMaster University show that using alternative painkillers may help cut down the dependence on these addictive medications. Researchers writing in the Canadian Medical Association Journal found that non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs such as ibuprofen are actually better at controlling pain than opioid-based codeine painkillers. The study adds that there are fewer undesirable reactions with non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs than codeine. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern says that the South Pacific Island nation is at one of the most challenging moments in the COVID-19 pandemic as lockdown restrictions in Auckland are extended by at least a week. From Sydney, Phil Masser reports.
43 new community cases of COVID-19 were reported Tuesday in New Zealand. The number of infections might be small compared to other countries, but in the New Zealand context, it is significant. Since the pandemic began, the South Pacific nation has recorded about 4,700 confirmed and probable cases. 28 people have died. Authorities said Monday that Auckland, the country's biggest city with 1.7 million residents, would remain at alert level 3 for at least one more week. The same measures, which restrict travel and make masks mandatory on public transport, apply to neighbouring regions Waikato and Northland. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern says the lockdowns are essential.
We know this has been an incredibly hard period for those in Auckland, but these measures, when followed, make all the difference. We want the R value, that's the reproduction of cases, to stay as close to one as possible. It has crept up a little in recent days. This means the number of cases will grow. If it moves up further, cases will grow faster. But if followed, our alert level restrictions can help control that spread.
Teachers and health and disability sector workers must be vaccinated against COVID-19 under a government mandate. New Zealand was among a small number of countries to drive coronavirus cases down to near zero last year because of border closures and snap lockdowns. However, an outbreak of the highly contagious Delta variant in August has frustrated efforts to stamp out transmission. Ardern has abandoned the long-held strategy of eliminating coronavirus. Instead, the country of 5 million plans to live with the virus and manage its spread as vaccination rates increase. But Ananish Chowdhury, a professor of behavioural and experimental economics at the University of Auckland, believes lockdowns are the wrong approach to containing the virus. He'd prefer more targeted protections for vulnerable groups, including the elderly, and he detects a growing frustration among the public.
The sense of solidarity is gone. Part of it is some missteps on the part of the government, for instance, not getting the vaccination rollout going much earlier. The economic costs are piling up. In Auckland, at least, the businesses are suffering. New Zealand businesses are mostly kind of small and medium-scale enterprises. So their ability to withstand this massive economic shock is very limited.
Ardern said strict lockdowns would end once 90% of New Zealand's eligible population was vaccinated. Health authorities said Tuesday the current figure was 58%. New Zealand's international borders remain closed to most foreign nationals. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
In Zimbabwe, the government is being argued to create a cancer tax to ease the burden for breast cancer treatment. Healthcare specialists note that cancer diagnosis and treatments are very expensive. Rutendo Mawere reports from Harare.
48-year-old Fungai Munyeza says that when she was informed that she had cancer, she thought it was the end of her life.
When I discovered my right breast nipple sagged in one morning, I panicked right away and consulted my GP. After going through an initial biopsy, I was told that cancerous cells had been found. And a few days later, I received the shocking news of my life that changed me, that I had stage 2B. Breast cancer. I was devastated.
Munyeza was also distressed because she knew how expensive cancer treatment is in the country and also what she had been charged to get a biopsy. Munyeza says patients need financial support.
The government should also subsidize on cancer treatment. A lot of people are not affording cancer drugs, they are way, way too expensive.
For Rumbidza Ikanukamwe, it was a lump in the breast and a series of misdiagnoses until the fourth diagnosis when the cancer was discovered, already at stage 3. Like Munyeza, Kanukamwe says she lacked information about the disease, but she knew that cancer treatment is expensive in Zimbabwe. Kanukamwe, who says she was charged between $2,000 to $3,000 for chemotherapy, says,
I couldn't believe it. I thought it was also a misdiagnosis in the beginning. I was really drowned in fear of death, fear that I would die, fear to leave my family, fear to leave my kids. I was in a state of shock. Cancer drugs are really expensive. It's not easy to access them. You can find them anywhere and everywhere, but financially, it's too exorbitant.
The Zimbabwe Cancer Registry says annual trends show that breast cancer is on the increase, with an average of 600 new cases recorded annually. According to the registry, breast cancer is more prevalent among those aged between 40 to 45 years of age. For VOA, this is Rutendo Mawere in Harare.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Remember to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a great week ahead.